Good morning, everyone. So we're going to now, having launched our studies in the book of Exodus by looking at that special name of God in chapter 3, verse 14, which is our watchword for the year. God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." That was our watchword for the year. We're now going to wind back to the start of the book of Exodus and begin the story. So we're looking at Exodus chapter 1, which I shall read to you. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiprah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Well, I began last week by looking at a few faces on the screen. Here are some more, rather contrasting in nature. Can you tell me who these are? And these are easy ones to start with. Saddam Hussein, yeah. I think we may have missed one before that, possibly. Is that right? Let's see what comes next. Saddam Hussein. Oh, here's another one. Colonel Gaddafi. The dictator of Libya. How about this one? A little more difficult. Ceausescu. Ceausescu. Yes, that's right. The dictator of the country of Romania, who fell in 1980-something. What about this chap? More of a challenge. That's right. What's his first name then, Chris? Hosni. That's right. Yes, just to see what's emerging. That's right. Slightly different set of faces to the liberators of last week, hey? The dictators, all of whom who have fallen in one way or another. I think we missed one out there. It was also Kim Il-sung from North Korea, who died in recent weeks. All in our lifetimes have met their downfall. Interestingly, I couldn't think of any female faces to include in this list. No, not Margaret Thatcher. She wasn't elected Prime Minister. So last week we were thinking of the great liberators who set their people free. This week, as we begin the story of Exodus, we're thinking about the great oppressors. The oppressor who brought those people into slavery, from whom they needed to be delivered. Now, the villain of the Exodus is, of course, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. In the Bible, he is the archetypal evil tyrant. And if you set Pharaoh in the context of his day, what happened with the lights? Hang on. In the context of his day, Pharaoh outranks those petty despots I have shown you by a million miles. I mean, they're just not comparable. That kind of those contemporary despots and leaders, they're fleas on the back of this man, Pharaoh. At the time of Exodus, Egypt is the main superpower in the known world. Its properties are, its own land is vast, and its influence extends far wider. Its might, its wealth, its achievements, and also its sins and atrocities were staggering in the context in which they lived. And the evidence of Egypt's civilization remains thousands of years later. We still go and visit the mighty pyramids and Sphinx and so on. What is going to remain of our civilization in 4,000 years' time? Are people still going to be visiting the O2 then? No. The Egyptians did things that are still around 4,000 years later and will probably outlive anything we do in this, our own generation. So then we're talking here about a mighty power, the mightiest conceivable power on earth. Yet, as we read this, let's remember that just as the liberator, last week we saw, was not the man Moses, he was simply the agent of God's liberation, so this week we need to recognize that the oppressor, the evil from which people must be freed, is not really Pharaoh, nor any of the other oppressors that we might name in this world. Let me point you to two New Testament verses that help us set this in context and cast light on that fact. Sorry, I should have put these on the screen and I neglected to. I'll give you time to find them. Firstly, Colossians chapter 1, verse 13. You'll find that on page 1182 of the New Testament, of the Chapel Bible, sorry. Speaking here of the rescue, the deliverance that we can all have through Jesus Christ. It says, "For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." You see, the big picture isn't human rulers like Pharaoh, it is the kingdom of darkness from which we must be rescued, a spiritual dimension. And if you turn back to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, a verse we looked at in some detail just over a year ago. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12 is page 1177, and it says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." That's the bigger picture. So the book of Exodus certainly does have things to say about political freedom. And it was historically, for example, great inspiration for African slaves in the Americas. But for us, as Christians in our world today, its primary value is as a picture of spiritual deliverance, which we find in Christ, whatever our setting might be. And to understand what that really means, we need to see that what we need to understand what we have been rescued from. The Bible's description of the evil tyrant Pharaoh will actually ring true of evil and oppression today in all its forms, great and small. So that's what we're going to look at. Perhaps a slightly grim start, but then with a Bible passage which ends with every boy being thrown in a river, you can't really have a cheerful sermon, can you, I'm afraid? Exodus chapter 1 begins with this description of evil. And we see that it is something real, powerful, and purposeful. By real, I mean that evil is not merely a cultural invention. It's not merely a concept that human beings have made up and applied as they see fit. Now, people whose view of the universe is essentially a materialistic one, they believe that actually there is nothing except matter and energy, that they will often use words like good and evil. And in fact, they will very often be a very moral people. They may even live comparatively very moral and good lives themselves and loathe wicked things and evil things being done. But when pressed on the matter, they have to agree that if you believe there's nothing but stuff, then good and evil are simply human conventions. They are human perceptions and interpretations of deeds, which actually have got no objective moral right or wrong. Good and evil don't exist anywhere except in human thought, if you are an atheist. The Bible, on the other hand, clearly assumes that there is an objective good and evil, that there is something real and absolute about those things. They're not simply made up by our thinking and our culture. I'm not sure I can point to a particular verse that directly expresses that humanistic argument, and I think that's probably because if you live in the real world, it is plainly stupid. It is so obvious that good and evil are real. Only people living in advanced civilizations, well cushioned from painful realities, could possibly believe that there is no such thing as evil in our world. Whereas if you live in a world where, for example, soldiers can and do turn up at your house, drag your baby from your arms and throw it in the river, then it's obvious, isn't it? We too must abandon any naive notions we might have that evil is just a human cultural invention, or even that it's just the absence of good. Evil is a reality that we must deal with. And what kind of reality? It's a powerful reality. Pharaoh came to power, it says. Pharaoh was able to do things. He was able to exert his will. At his word, whole armies could be mobilized. Nations could be enslaved. Whole communities could be slaughtered. Resources could be diverted entirely to his own glory in building his temples and palaces. This power was not his own. It was only allowed to him by God for his own inscrutable purposes. But it was real power. And the same must be said of evil today. The spiritual evils at work in our world have been given for a time the scope to do real damage. Whether that is through brutal force in an oppressive regime, or simply through the subtle deceits of a modern Western society. The damage they do is real. It's real power. And if you think about it, for example, we dispose of more babies in the Western world today in one day than Pharaoh probably managed in a whole lifetime. And evil is so powerful that most people don't even give that a second thought. And it's also a purposeful reality. By which I mean, evil is not like a hurricane or a volcano, a mindless destructive energy that wreaks random havoc wherever it happens to hit. We're talking about something that is purposeful, deliberate, and personal. So Pharaoh thinks, come, we must deal shrewdly with them. He deliberately sets out a plan to make the Hebrews slaves. Now, he didn't have any greater purpose than to cover his own back. They were worried they'd side with his enemy. But there was a greater deliberate purpose at work behind the scenes, as there has been through all history and is today. We have a spiritual enemy who's purposefully and deliberately setting out to oppose the work of God as he seeks to redeem and save mankind. And that's the backstory to Exodus chapter 1. God had a plan of salvation that begins to be worked out in the book of Genesis. It was to choose a man, Abraham, and make a promise to him. You will father a great nation. They will inherit a good land, and they will bless the whole world. The book of Genesis tells us how that promise goes down the generations through Isaac and Jacob and then to his sons such as Joseph. But as Genesis ends, we find that ultimately they're not a great nation in their own land. They still remain a small family of guests in an overwhelmingly pagan empire. But we read in verse 6 what has then happened between these two books, Genesis and Exodus. Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so the land was filled with them. So we see that whilst they've been in exile, against expectation, God has been beginning to fulfill his promise to build them into a great nation. And we can certainly understand that Pharaoh's attempt at a final solution to the Hebrew problem was in fact prompted by the devil attempting to thwart God's salvation plan for mankind. We need to understand that every great evil has the human factor. It involves people making their own wicked decisions for their own reasons, and if we get to know them, we might understand those reasons. But we also need to understand the reverse is true. Every great evil has this spiritual dimension, which means it can never be completely explained or understood simply by human beings making their choices. That's not an excuse for the Gaddafis, Mubaraks, Pharaohs and Husseins, but it explains at a deeper level what's going on. It's not just that human nature is wicked. In particular, it helps us see why Christian faith is as oppressed and Christians are as persecuted quite as much as they have been in history, out of all proportion to what you might expect in the general hurly-burly of life. And you could say the same about Jewish peoples too. The levels of persecution they have experienced, again, far above and beyond the sort of average you might get for any particular ethnic group. So we need to understand this. I mean, it's not a pleasant thought, but it's necessary for us to understand. Spiritual evil is real, powerful, and purposeful. We must not underestimate it. Now, those are the main points, but here are a few more observations, and I think they help us understand and nuance a bit more the dimensions of it, especially in its human form. We also see that evil is forgetful, verse 8. A new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Egyptian scholars suggest two possible dates when this might have been, where it could fit, the historical evidence could fit with what we find in the scriptures, and the arguments for both you can look up in books. But the point is, the previous Pharaoh and his descendants had been blessed by God through Joseph and his family, but that has now been forgotten. This new Pharaoh, whoever he was, just knew nothing of that. God's blessing in the past to him and his nation had gone from the corporate memory of the Pharaoh and his nation. That kind of ignorance of God's past blessings, and indeed of his future judgments, that is something that's growing in our society today, isn't it? People know less and less of how much God has done for us as a nation. That should worry us, shouldn't it? But we also see that evil is essentially a fearful thing as well. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will be even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies. We see that at a human level, Pharaoh was motivated by fear. He did have an alternative, you see. He could have thought this. Look, He could have reacted with trust and faith. He could have said, look, see how these Hebrews have grown. There must be something special about them. They've been blessed by their God, aren't they? You know what we should do? We should treat these people well. We should respect them. And then they will be our allies and our nation will be blessed by their presence. That would have been a perfectly rational response on his part, wouldn't it? And probably far would have been far better in his own interests. But the nature of evil, the nature of wickedness, is that it's fundamentally, at its very heart, irrational. And it just cannot trust. It's just not in the repertoire. Or put it another way, when sin and evil has got a grip on us, we will always tend to read our own tendencies into others. If we spend our lives lying and cheating, we just assume that other people we meet will lie and cheat just like we do. If we've been unfaithful to our partners, we just assume that that's how they're going to behave towards us. That's what it does to us, poisons our thinking and fills us with fear. Evil regimes throughout history have seized upon the fears of people and exploited them to the purposes of evil. The classic example of that is the Nazi persecution of Jews, but you can find many others. As well as that, we find that, of course, this list goes on, but it's worth having this little diagnosis here. Evil is prideful. Pharaoh thinks he's in charge. He believes, consciously or not, that he can overturn the express will of God. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. We see that evil is also insatiable. It never has enough. It always wants more. Evil never thinks, well, that's enough for now. I think, you know, we've tried that strategy. It doesn't really work. We need to step back, look again at what we're doing, and maybe choose a better path. No, it just doesn't think like that. Evil has its goals, and if they're not achieved, it just wants more and more and more. We get trapped in cycles like that too, don't we? Perhaps when we get hooked on something, addicted to something, it takes a little bit more, then a bit more, then a bit more. It's never satisfied. It always wants more of you. Pharaoh always wants more bricks every day. Evil is brutal as well. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all the people, every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile. And we see that when tyrants in history have enforced their evil upon their servants, what happens is those people who serve him are themselves dehumanized. It removes the capacity for compassion. And people do dreadful things just because they were obeying orders. To us, the idea that we might strangle a baby and throw one in a river is so horrible and inconceivable. There's no way ordinary people like us would do that, is there? Yet the evidence of history is that when evil takes this kind of grip, ordinary people like you and me do things like that. What was really awful about the massacres that we had in places like Rwanda and the Balkans is that they weren't perpetrated by a small group of murderous psychotics. They were ordinary people who did these terrible things to their neighbours, motivated by ignorance and fear, and when the restraints of civilization were lifted, ordinary people did these terrible things. So the list is building up of this picture of what evil's like. Real, powerful and purposeful, yet also forgetful, fearful, prideful, insatiable and brutal. And that sounds like enough to be going on with. But I think there's one more word that we need to add as well. Because ultimately, evil is also farcical. It is, in the end, a deeply tragic, utterly unfunny joke. for all the gross wickedness of his actions, if you actually look at Pharaoh himself, he cuts a really pathetic figure, both in this chapter, but also as the story goes on. And it begins here. What does he say again to them? The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names are Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the mid-Hebrew women in childbirth, kill the boys. Well, Pharaoh, if you really want to get rid of these people, if you need, why haven't you got the guts to do it yourself? Can't you do a little better than get the midwives to do the dirty work for you? Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked him, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. Pharaoh, when they don't do what you say, what kind of idiot would believe a story like that? Come on. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became ever more numerous. Pharaoh, when you realize that you are pitting your puny strength against Almighty God, what kind of idiot keeps on going? Well, it's this kind of idiot, isn't it? And the later chapters are going to reveal just how stupidly hard-headed this Pharaoh is. And in fact, all evil is ultimately irrational, isn't it? If you think about it, how crazy can you get than to rebel against the living God? What the tyrants do is not amusing. I'm not trying to say it's amusing, but there's something farcical about it. Mere man takes on God. And the Bible tells us how God himself reacts when the kings of the earth take their stand against him in Psalm 2. Because it says, the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them, at people like Pharaoh. In the time of the Second World War, one of the most effective propaganda tools against the evils of fascism, and Hitler himself in particular, wasn't necessarily the newsreels. One of them, in America particularly, was the film by Charlie Chaplin, The Great Dictator. Because in that film, Charlie Chaplin showed not just how wicked Nazi regime's deeds were, but also how ridiculous Hitler himself was, with his silly little tash and all that. Now later, Chaplin himself said he couldn't have made a comic film had he known just how badly Hitler was oppressing the Jews. Nonetheless, that black humour that revealed the evil yet ridiculed the one who did it was a very valuable weapon at the time. And it's a biblical principle. God himself laughs at Pharaoh. All evil, all sin, all rebellion against God is ultimately inane, stupid and farcical, as if we could prevail against him. So we shouldn't spend too long looking for profound reasons to understand it. In fact, the more wicked people become, the more shallow and vacuous and empty they end up. But before we continue, let's see this very clearly. What we've described here, evil primarily as it manifests in the mind and actions of people we've called tyrants, and situations we think of as extremes and atrocities. But what we need to see is that these features of evil that appear so clearly in someone like Pharaoh are also evident in our own hearts, in our own little meek, unremarkable, bourgeois, mass-produced, over-the-counter retail sins. These features are there. We too have a sinful nature that rebels against God and enslaves our souls. It too is real, powerful, and purposeful. Something inside us wants to grab the wheel of life, take control, and run things for ourselves. We are our own worst Pharaoh and slave driver within. When we sin against God, even in some unambitious way, that doesn't involve chucking babies in a river. Maybe it's just a little sin, you know, a little click on a screen or a few loose words or the enjoyment of a forbidden thought. Nonetheless, like Pharaoh, we're being forgetful of God's past blessings and future judgments. We're being fearful, perhaps. Oh, well, I'll miss out if I don't join in now and seize my chance. We're being prideful I think I can run my life better than God can. And yet we're giving way to something insatiable, something that cannot be satisfied. And we're becoming brutal. Because when we engage in sin, what it does is eat away at our humanity and makes us less of a person. And ultimately doing something farcical, ridiculous and laughable, as if we could get away with it, prevail against God. Righteousness dignifies human beings. Sin turns us into a sick joke. The story of Exodus will help us see how we can break free from the Pharaoh that is our own heart, from the slave driver within, from the cruel oppression that afflicts our own lives. It's a picture of what Jesus Christ can do for us through his death on the cross to pay for our sin and his resurrection to give us new life. So I hope you keep coming back for the answers to these issues. But in chapter 1, we give the first hint. We find the first hint of how God achieves this. Pharaoh's first attempt at a final solution seems to have been a covert one. Behind the scenes, he naively thinks his power is so great, he can tell these midwives to murder baby boys, and they will do it. Now, I often think when I'm attempting to persuade Johnny to eat any vegetable that is not a carrot, he steadfastly refuses. And he will refuse in the face of all cajoling, all threats, all bribes. And I comfort myself by the thought that not even the President of the United States of America could get him to eat any vegetable that is not a carrot. You could squeeze it in by force, I suppose, but the greatest power on earth could not get him to do it willingly. Well, Pharaoh encounters the limit to his power in the most ironic way he can, doesn't he? In the mind and the will of these otherwise totally ordinary ladies. He has no control over what will happen in their hearts. And it's not just because of their natural compassion. It's not just because of their professional principles as midwives. It's because, in verse 17, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them. They disobeyed Pharaoh. God's will clearly trumped human authority. Now that's a biblical principle generally accepted. No human ruler, however much authority they have from God, can force a believer to do what God has forbidden or prevent a believer from doing what God has commanded. What they did next is sometimes a bit more controversial. Because he asked them why they let the boys live, and the midwives answered, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, they're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. And the question is, did they actually tell a lie? Or was this simply an economy with the truth? And does the context of saving lives justify what seems to be a deceit? And what right did Pharaoh have to know the truth anyway? Strictly speaking, this is hardly a case of maliciously giving false witness against one neighbour. And of course, that's what the commandment would later forbid. It doesn't say, does it, the commandment, thou shalt never tell a lie. It says, don't make false witness against your neighbour. However we're to understand what they did, what we need to see is the Bible's verdict upon them and their actions. In an Old Testament narrative, you can often tell whether an action is right or wrong in God's eyes by the outcome that he brings about. That's how you understand the moral message from an Old Testament passage. What outcome does God bring about? And it's about as clear as you can get. God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. So it's pretty clear, I think, that whatever you make of their specific actions, overall, God approved of them. The midwives' actions are affirmed. They did the right thing. And as various commentators have noted, we don't know the name of this Pharaoh, but Scripture has recorded the names of these midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, for all posterity. In fact, in the first two chapters of Exodus, Pharaoh's and the devil, the enemy's evil plans are thwarted entirely by female characters. The midwives, Moses' mum and sister, and even Pharaoh's own daughter, In these first two chapters, the men themselves are totally useless, mostly absent or scrapping amongst each other, or even like Moses, making a complete pig's ear of everything. The women are the ones who have to take the lead in chapters 1 and 2. They are the women of the resistance against Pharaoh. So perhaps you can imagine them in long overcoats with white ankle socks and saying, "Listen very carefully, I shall say this only once." We must ask, what was the source of their courage, that they could take their stand against the mightiest power on earth? What caused people so weak, vulnerable, nobodies in the grand scheme of things, to be so courageous? And why did God honour and bless them? The Bible says it twice to make it absolutely clear. The midwives feared God, verse 17. The midwives feared God. They were brave because they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh or anything he could do to them. And that is God's way in to this story. That is how he makes his presence felt in the very beginning of the Exodus. That's how he starts his people on the long road to freedom. It all begins with a few people who fear him more than they fear that man, Pharaoh. And it's still his way in now. It's his way in to your life. It's his way into your family, your school or workplace, your halls of residence, your street, your nation. God breaks in, sets people free through those who fear him more than they fear anything else. Whether that's reprisal from the authorities, ridicule from your friends, rejection from your home, whether it's even frustration of your own urges. Maybe it's just what you fear will happen inside yourself if you honour God. No, if you fear God more, that is what God can use. So take your example from these brave Hebrew midwives, if they inspire you. Or take your pick from any number of biblical heroes who by faith knew a God greater than any force in this world. But above them all, set Jesus Christ is the greatest of them all. Hebrews 12 verse 2 says, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart."